Jobs, cancer, and uncertainty, the story of a Maine mill town. Author Carrie Arsenault is from Mexico, Maine, where most every family she knew included someone who worked at the mill. In her new book, Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains, Arsenault digs into the town's legacy as, quote, Cancer Alley, and the dangers of working at the mill. She also explores her family's Acadian heritage and Maine history, and connects it all in a profound look at the American dream and the plight of small industrial towns like Mexico. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Carrie Arsenault is our guest. Did you grow up in a mill town? Do you feel conflicted about the place your family calls home? Have you ever wondered about the health of your community? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Mill towns in Maine once were the source of economic opportunity and local pride, but the mills were also the source of toxic chemicals and environmental degradation. And today, those communities are grappling with an uncertain future. Our guest today is Carrie Arsenault. She is a book critic, book editor at Orion Magazine, and contributing editor at the Literary Hub. She grew up in Mexico, Maine, and is the author of the book Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. We invite your questions and comments. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Carrie, welcome to Maine Calling. Let's begin with some of the characters in Milltown. There's so many people that you introduce in the book and people who you come to either meet or learn about in your journey. And I want you to tell us about Doc Martin, because his work and what he discovered and what he was not able to sort of get through to others is central to the story of your community.
Yeah. So Doc Martin was the town doctor in our town, in Rumford. He worked at the Rumford Community Hospital. And I met him only through his widowed wife, Carrie Martin, who became not only a huge resource for me, but became a really good friend of mine. For the past 10 years, she's been sort of guiding me through. And really what happened was when I met with her, I started to find all this kind of information about cancer and all this stuff. And I thought, oh, yeah, we used to say, joke about it, you know, Cancer Valley, ha ha. And somebody said, you know, call Terry Martin. She knows a lot about this. And so I did. And, you know, that really led me down this other path. You know, at first it was genealogy, and then it became more about disease and toxics and the pollution from the mill. So she told me, I'll try to sum it up, but she explained to me over the years that she and Doc Martin both tried to sort of warn, you know, leaders of the state and the community and the mill. And, you know, he was seeing people that were getting sick, and it seemed to be connected to some research he was seeing about dioxins and paper bleaching process. And he was seeing a lot of really rare cancers come through his, you know, clinic door. And he also had people talking to him privately, you know, among the privacy of a doctor-patient relationship, and tell him things that he found very unsettling about things that may have happened at the mill, that, you know, chemicals or toxics that were not really taken care of properly, I'll say.
In your book, several of the people who you care about or come to find out about have been, a phrase I didn't know, gassed at the mill. Tell me what that means and what happened to them.
Yeah, so getting gassed at the mill, too, is another kind of thing. It seemed to happen to a lot of people, and it would just come up in conversation as I was talking to people, and it happened to my father, too. But basically, when the chlorine dioxide turns into a gaseous state, I might be getting this a little wrong because I have a terrible memory, but it can get released in the mill, and it can get into your lungs and makes you feel like you're basically choking to death. And it can have, you know, it depends how much of a dose you get, it can have a certain amount of harm or not. Like, there are people that it happened to that it didn't really harm them. And then it was somebody like my uncle Pete, who basically was really sick after that and died soon thereafter. You know, I think within a couple of years, I said, I can't remember. He wasn't alive mm-hmm. when I was mm-hmm. born. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you're tracing the health and you're tracing, you know, this notion of Cancer Valley. At the same mm-hmm. time, you're looking at the lives of the people that you've grown up with and mm-hmm. and the future of the mill, and you look at the history of the mill and what happens after the founding family is no longer associated with it. And boy, Carrie, I get the sense reading this book that you just feel bad for your hometown.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, me personally, is it a question to me or you feel bad for your my hometown? I mean, do you feel bad for them? Because I do, I feel, I don't know if feeling bad is the right way to say it, but I feel like there's been a lot of injustice served up on a plate to people in my town and people in small towns across America like this, where,
yeah,
you know,
I guess that's what I mean. A yeah. sort of a big unfairness.
Yeah. I mean, they're more susceptible to a lot of social injustices and environmental injustices that more wealthy people are not. They, you know, they live downstream instead of upstream. You know, it's a common thing that happens all over America, all over the world, really. You know, people are sort of relegated to these sacrifice zones, they're also called, which is kind of a terrible word, but that's what these places are called. They're called sacrifice zones, where people are basically sacrificed for, you know, corporations. You know, I mean, there's been 40, 50 years of policy, maybe even longer, that have valued corporations over human life. And I think that's really at the nut of it is why this is allowed to happen to people, money over life.
Hmm. One of the things that strikes me as I read Milltown, Carrie, is how people will talk about rivers, especially the Androscoggin River, in the past, about how it used to be. Mm. I remember, my husband even said that to me. I remember going up to camp and a hunting camp and the Androscoggin River was foamy. And people have the sense that this is something that is in the past and firmly in the past, and that the pollution no longer exists because of the Clean Water and Clean Air Act, and that things are different now. How do you feel about that sort of broad sense that people have?
Well, I think it's true that it is different. I mean, I grew up and the river was smelly and rainbow colored, and everything in it was dead. But, and so a lot of that stuff did get cleaned up. There are eagles flying on the lake now. There have been improvements, but some of the more insidious things are not seen, you know? So it's, and that's part of what this book is about those unseen things that are kind of hidden and that we don't see, like dioxin, like I mentioned earlier, which is a byproduct of the bleaching process. You know, dioxins have a half-life of like 11 years, and they bioaccumulate, and they're persistent chemicals like PCBs or PFAS chemicals, which everybody's talking about now. And dioxins, you know, they bioaccumulate in our bodies, so the further up the food chain they travel, the more concentrated and toxic they become. And at the top of that food chain is us, the human body. So these dioxins are, you know, still in the sediment in the river, they're still in the fish, they're still in the fish that go downstream. So, and they're still in the, you know, milk in the cows, and then we drink the milk of the cow. I mean, dioxin is in every single body, right? And I guess that I may have even heard this from somebody who might be joining us later, that dioxin levels are 77 times higher than the EPA recommends in breastfeeding babies. So it's not history, it's current. And it just feels like dioxin sort of went away. It was kind of shoved aside because, you know, the EPA had sort of put a lid on dealing with it. And it issued a report, a non-cancer report about the effects of dioxin. They didn't issue a cancer report, but a non-cancer report. And it sort of put a lid on it, tamped it down. And then everybody just moved on. So I would say it's definitely not in the past. There's a lot of problems with it to this day.
Carrie, as you were researching this book and in the months since it's come out, I'm wondering what the response has been. Have there been people who are angry with you for sort of uncovering secrets?
I haven't heard from them, if they are. I haven't, but that doesn't mean that people aren't angry. Silence can be a form of anger, too. Like, I haven't heard from Janet Mills or Angus King, who I sent books to. I don't know. Maybe they're not angry, but the only, you know, sort of funny response I got was from the economic developer right in the beginning, or before the book even came out, so he hadn't read the book, said that, back to your other question, he said, well, this is all in the past. You know, I'm looking towards the future. And that was the only kind of, but otherwise, it's been, people have been hugely supportive of this story. And I'm really happy about that. Maybe we'll hear from different people today.
That's right. And maybe we will. And I do invite everybody to call in, especially if you grew up in a mill town or in the Rumford, Mexico area. And our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Carrie, there are so many undercurrents in your book, but a big one is sort of the whole notion of the American dream. So many of the people in the town of Mexico came to America from another country, from Canada, came there looking for the American dream, in some ways achieved it, but paid a great price for it.
That is the conundrum of the American dream. So therefore, I ask, was it really such a thing as an American dream? I mean, we like to think, you know, in the late 19th century that, you know, people were moving up, you know, but they really moved up en masse. Like, all of America is moving up, all standards of living rose, not just the working class. But it wasn't long after that, then the sort of divide started happening. And it's been, you know, now it's like a chasm, right? And then moving fast forward, like I said, 40, 50 years of policy that value corporations over humans, you know, with, and then there's globalization, which really didn't really help small rural industrial towns that were already suffering because industry was sort of going away and dying or moving overseas, or the necessity for paper, like in our town, is becoming less and less. There was a lot of things that sort of fed into that not the American dream. I mean, and not only that, but like were people being poisoned from the very get-go? Is that really a dream that anybody had? I don't know. There are the people that I feel like people that worked in the paper mill, at least my father, my family, their lives were transactions. You know, they helped turn trees into paper, and paper fed the pollution. And then when the pollution flowed back into their bodies and the bodies of water that fed the growth of trees, the process would start all over again. Is that really a dream? I'm not sure.
One part of the book I thought was really interesting is your understanding, in a way that many of your friends did not understand, how President Trump got elected. And in light of what's happening right now in Washington, yeah. And in light, I'm just wondering, if you want to reflect on how people who do not live in towns like Mexico and just don't understand how people can vote for Donald Trump, and those, many of our listeners are among those, how do you see it?
I understand.
I like your analogy of the limousine. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. I understand why people voted for him. Let's just say that. And the analogy of a limousine is like, let me see if I can get this right. You know, in the 2016 election, it was like, people were driving by in limousines. I'm going to say it wrong. I'll just wing it. So it's such a complicated thing, especially in light of January 6th. But
I'm sorry. I'm trying to find it in your book. Here, I found it.
Okay. You can read it. Or I should say, people have been disenfranchised of the things I've been talking about: globalization, the American dream, industry going away, economic frustration. I would also add to that that, you know, nobody is equal. We were taught that society is, you know, just, and if you work hard, you're going to, you know, make it. But it's not really true. We're not equal. We don't start as a working class person. I didn't start equal to the people I went to college with. Not only that, you know, we also push this idea of upward mobility through education. So I went to college and it was like, yeah, you're going to get educated. And that's an implicit in that idea is an insult. If you don't go to college, you're a failure and it's your fault. And so what that did too, in addition to all these other things, is that it said, well, working class jobs aren't as valuable, right? Education is, college jobs are. So that provided also a loss of dignity. And I think that connected that resentment of the elite, which I grew up with. We did resent in some ways elite people, although we admired rich people like Trump because we wanted that. But we didn't want the elite sort of looking down upon us and saying, you need to get an education. And if you don't, I mean, I'm putting words in people's mouth, but this is just a summary. That value of education was just never as valued as working class, you know? And I think that feeding into the globalization, feeding into industry dying, Trump filled a vacuum of some of that too. And also globalization has devalued or ignored a sense of national identity. And I think that's happened all over the world. I lived in Sweden and I saw it there too. And I think some of this is a backlash to that cosmopolitan, to that global sort of identity and that people are having. People don't want to belong to a homogenous world. They want their community. And I understand that. But what came of it is like nationalism instead of a national identity, right? And mm-hmm. Trump filled that vacuum of national pride and identity. And he also drove into towns like working class towns in 2016. And he said, I see you. You know, he might have lied. Well, he did lie. I mean, he lied about everything. But he pretended or said he saw us. Whereas I think the Democrats really failed in that, sort of really identifying the working class and what was going on in these towns. So part of me writing this wasn't even political, but it just happened to be, you know, this is what's going on in these working class towns because you didn't bother to come here.
We're speaking with Carrie Arsenault, the author of Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. We do need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Maine Bureau of Agriculture's Maine Agricultural Trades Show online, January 19th to the 23rd. Details at GetRealMaine.com.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Senate filibuster became a tool of obstruction. It dates back to the Jim Crow era when Southern senators wanted to preserve white supremacy, according to our next guest, Adam Gentleson, author of Killswitch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. He used to be Harry Reid's deputy chief of staff. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 8 o'clock. There is a chance we will be having NPR special coverage at that time. We'll keep you posted.
Hi, I'm Jeff Douglas. Every Day As It Happens connects you with the stories in the news by connecting with the people connected with those stories. For nearly 50 years, we have done that using one simple tool, the telephone. Whether that story is political, personal, or just peculiar, we'll find out one phone call at a time. As It Happens, where there's always a lot on the line.
And As It Happens is scheduled for 9 o'clock this evening.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are discussing author Carrie Arsenault's new book, Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. Share your comments or questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Richard Clapp, Professor Emeritus at Boston University School of Public Health and founding director of the Massachusetts Cancer Registry. He was born and raised in Lewiston. Dick, thanks for giving us a call. And tell us what you know about paper mill operations from growing up on the Androscoggin River.
Well, first, thanks for inviting me. I grew up downriver. You know, the Androscoggin was, the Lewiston was downriver from the pulp and paper mills up in both Rumford, Mexico, and in New Hampshire. So what I knew of the pulp and paper mills at that time was the river in Lewiston smelled bad, and there was foam along the shore of the river that was, you know, coming downstream from the pulp and paper mills. So, I played basketball, and our team from Lewiston went to Rumford to play against their team one year. And I remember the bus coming down the hill into Rumford and this overwhelming smell that, you know, occurred. So I was aware already of the, I think Kerry called it a rotten eggs smell.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what I knew about it growing up.
How did you get involved in looking at cancer rates in the Mexico Rumford area?
Well, as you introduced me, I was director of the Massachusetts Cancer Registry, and Maine was setting up its cancer registry at approximately the same time in the 1980s. And so I actually consulted with the people who were setting up the Maine Cancer Registry. We set up an agreement whereby Maine residents that came to Massachusetts hospitals to get diagnosed, we would send information confidentially back to the Maine Cancer Registry so they had a complete count. And it was in that context that I began to know about and become interested in Maine cancer rates. And then later, workers in the pulp and paper industry were concerned that there were, you know, too many people getting or dying of cancer in Maine. So I delved into it more deeply.
Mm. So tell us what you found. What do people in Maine need to know?
Well, again, this is from the type of bleaching that was done years ago that I think the most toxic chemical that was produced, and that was dioxin, again, as Kerry has mentioned. And dioxin is one of the contaminants of Agent Orange, which is used in Vietnam to defoliate trees. But it also appears, and I actually did research on this for my doctoral dissertation, appears to have caused excess cancer of various types in Vietnam veterans. So, and most likely because of the dioxin that was in the Agent Orange. So as dioxin is produced in the pulp and paper mill bleaching process, the workers in the mill especially, but also people who eat fish or even eat lobsters, the tamale, the green stuff in lobsters, were exposed to dioxin through their diet. And so that's what I was worried about, is that the main pulp and paper mill workers were going to get excess cancers of the types that we were already seeing in Vietnam vets. And they did. And there was a study of causes of death in the Oxford County area, and people who worked, as according to their death certificate in the pulp and paper industry, had an excess deaths due to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is, you know, cancer of the lymph cells, which is one of the ones that Vietnam veterans, for example, get compensated for because it's presumed to be due to their dioxin exposure. So that already
Richard,
was.
Richard, I'm wondering if you found resistance to your findings, if you found a history of either trying to cover up or discredit findings linking what happens and happened at the mills to cancer rates.
You know, I didn't personally experience that, but the NIOSH study was controversial when it came out. I'm sure that the pulp and paper industry, or even Boise Cascade at the time, had consultants who said, well, you can't prove anything, and this doesn't show anything. Who knows what it was, that kind of resistance. I was part of a discussion, at least, of the effluents from the pulp and paper mill organized by the Consensus Building Institute. This is something that Kerry mentions in the book, and they tried to get all parties together to talk about what to do. And I know there was controversy at that point about, well, is the mill causing excess cancer? Wasn't to me directly, but it was to whoever had done these studies.
Sure. And Richard, what about today? Should people be concerned about fish from these rivers, lobster downstream?
You know, the EPA now tests fish and lobster, and the levels are going down. It's still in the silt, as Carrie said. So it goes downstream. That's how it gets to the lobsters. It gets down as far as Merrymeeting Bay and the main coast. But it's at lower levels. I think there still is an advisory that pregnant women or women considering becoming pregnant should not eat the tamale in Maine lobsters as a sort of dietary advice every summer. As I recall, when Angus King was governor, he actually said something to the assembled pulp and paper industry folks that, he said, you could make my life a lot easier if you stopped using the kind of bleaching that produces dioxin. And so they did. They switched. And now they use something called chlorine dioxide, which has less chance of producing dioxin as a byproduct.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Richard Clapp, Professor Emeritus at Boston University School of Public Health, founding director of the Massachusetts Cancer Registry. Carrie, I noticed in the very front of your book, you make a point of talking about the kind of paper that's being used in the book. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
Tell me.
Yeah. So I thanks, Richard, for coming on. That was, I just like took a bunch of notes. So I really, in my book contract, needed to ensure that the paper was bleached without using chlorine gas, chlorine dioxide, which Richard just mentioned, or any other chlorine-based bleaching agent. And it's something I would really like a lot of other publishers to do. But it's hard because my publisher had to go to Canada to find the paper. But it's also in response to something one of the mill workers said when I was talking to them during writing the book. I said, well, why don't you use this kind? Why don't you make this kind of paper? And he said, because nobody is buying it. So it's really, if he's like, if there was a demand, we would make that kind of paper. So that's something I'd really like to focus on this coming year, is to talk to publishers and editors and see if they will, too, at least look into it,
And we could go now to Severin Beliveau, calling from Rangeley. Hi, Severin. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, ma'am. My pleasure. My own rugged
Hi.
Rural Rangeley. Morning. Hi, Carrie.
Severin, tell me about your perspective on the paper industry and Carrie's book.
Yes, well, obviously we all admired what she wrote, and it was a great analysis of her family's experience, but also what we all experienced as I was I'm a native of Rumford and the product of a paper mill company. But my question involves the future of the paper industry, and I guess with the closings of the various paper mills in Millinocket, East Millinocket, Madison, Westbrook, Lincoln, Bucksport, and the loss of the production in many of the mills in Rumford and Old Town, as examples, and the additional fact that many of these remaining companies, particularly Rumford and Old Town, are owned by foreign interests, in this case, Chinese companies. My question to Carrie is, Carrie, based upon your extensive research, in your opinion, what is the future of the paper industry here in Maine?
Well, hi, Severin. Nice to hear from you. My opinion, I want to preface this by saying I'm a writer, not an economic advisor or anything. But I did talk to a paper consultant that actually used to own a paper mill as well. And that's as far as I'll go because he doesn't want to be identified. But he said the paper industry is basically on its way out. In Maine, at least, or even in America, he said you can grow a tree in South America in 5 years, like a fully grown tree, whereas in Maine, it takes 50, 60 years. So right there, the natural resources, it also is just expensive in Maine. There's higher taxes. We have like laws, environmental laws, as we've been discussing a little bit. There's just a lot of pressures on making paper in the United States. And Maine is very isolated and we just don't have the sort of, he told me you could, barge up, logs or paper from South America and it's cheaper than, making it in Maine, shipping it out. So he really insists that it's basically just a ticking, it's tick tock, time is running out, which is not a good, contrary to what people may think, I think it's kind of a little bit of a horrible thing. I mean, a lot of people's identities and a lot of their livelihoods and everything is tied up in paper and forestry industry. So I think it's up to our leaders to start thinking about what happens next.
Yeah.
And that's coming soon.
Yeah. Well, the paper mills have been the economic backbone of the state for generations. And you're right. And you can, and we're not recovering from it. It's not as if these mills can be converted into for other uses, even though there are attempts are being made in certain mills. But you're right. It's really a challenge. And I don't know what our leaders are doing on this. All those factors you mentioned, taxes, labor, but yeah, more importantly, our geology up here, just the fact that we're that we have these cold winters and growing season is so limited. Well, anyway, I think your analysis in your book was right on too. Many of the factors that contributed to it, but anyway, as I said, when I was being born and raised in Rumford, it was a thriving paper mill community, and now to see where Rumford and some of these towns are today is really kind of scary. And I'm just hoping that we can all get together and find other uses for those facilities, because they're huge. They're huge. And mm-hmm. I mean, in this case, the fact that you can ship pulp from Rumford in Old Town to China and then convert it into paper there, and then yeah, for it to be returned to the United States in the form of paper, and still cheaper than producing it in Maine or New England. It doesn't make sense, but apparently it does. Apparently it makes economic sense, but that's beyond my pay grade. But anyway,
thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for calling
in.
We're going to go to Suzanne, who says that she grew up in Chisholm. Hi, Suzanne, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I could write my own book. Okay, Chisholm was founded by Hugh Chisholm, who founded the mills in Mexico and Rumford, but people don't talk about Chisholm anymore. But my best friend died at the age of 21 of pancreatic cancer. Her whole family lived down the river, the Androscoggin River, by the falls and Livermore Falls. My right across, my niece, 14 months old, was rushed by my brother to Boston, where she died of leukemia. My brother drove her home in the back of his car, which was one of the saddest episodes of my life. She's where she's buried, right across the next lot. There's Ray Simoneaux, who died, I believe, at the age of 20 or 21. I remember we were out walking around just on college break, and he was coughing and wondering what was wrong with him. Mm. I had an aunt who died of breast cancer. My mother was mill nurse at the old Otis Mill. I'm 89 years old, by the way, and I grew up with the stench of sulfur in the air so bad that I would crawl home up the hill from the mill, from the main street. Interestingly enough, I could, as I said, I could write my own book. I think it's called the Evergreen Cemetery off Stevens Avenue in Portland, and I saw mm-hmm. this beautiful mausoleum, and I thought, oh, I wonder who was that is, what that mausoleum is named after. And I couldn't see any name until I walked in the front and I saw Chisholm and letters on the front. So I walked up the steps and looked in, and it's a monument to Hugh Chisholm, who founded these mills.
That's right, Suzanne. And Carrie, you write about Hugh Chisholm in the book.
I do. Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for calling. Yeah, I do write about Hugh Chisholm in the book quite a bit, and sort of the effect he's had on our whole state. And I even write about that mausoleum. In fact, I found the same kind of surprise, I think, that you did. I think you probably could write a book, or I have a project going on now that I'm going to include everybody in Maine to contribute to. It's called the Cancer Yearbook. And what I'm doing is recording the people in Maine who have died of cancer and think that it may be involved with paper mill pollution. And that's on my website. If anybody wants to reach out, they can. I just started it. It's part of a longer project. But anyway, we can.
Carrie, we will. We will post that we'll link that onto our Maine Culling website as well. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments for Carrie Arsenault. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Lunder Foundation in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, who are bringing the museum to you online at colby.edu/museum.
I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. With just over a week to go in his administration, calls for President Trump to resign or be removed from office continue after last week's assault on the Capitol.
Also, states are struggling to get enough of the coronavirus vaccine into enough arms. That's next time on Here and Now.
And Here and Now coming up in about 20 minutes at noon. The PBS NewsHour on Maine Public Television provides in-depth news and analysis of the issues that matter to you. It can be seen weekday evenings at 6, 7, and 11. The NewsHour brings you the top stories objectively examined and discussed in-depth with differing viewpoints. It's television news you can trust, helping make sense of our complicated and ever-changing world. The PBS NewsHour at 6, 7, and 11 weeknights on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, The Maine Mill Town, my guest Carrie Arsenault, who is a book critic, book editor at Orion Magazine, and contributing editor at the Literary Hub. She is also a mentor for Penn America's Prison and Justice Writing Program, and we are discussing her highly acclaimed book, Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Dennis calling from Topsom. Hi, Dennis. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. And Carrie, that's a wonderful book that you've written. What I'd like to ask you basically, and I'm going to assume that a small percentage of people really aren't that familiar with Rumford or Mexico. And my experience with Rumford in Mexico goes back 38 years ago when I was working with Earl Shuttleworth and others who were having me do some photography associated with historic preservation and things of that sort. And I photographed a place called Strathglass Park, which I, you know, being an outsider, was sort of impressed with as a community. And I want to ask Carrie if she knows about it. And also, Carrie, on the lighter side, talk about the Mexico chicken coop.
Yeah, and Carrie, you do write about the park he's talking about, the housing development.
I do. So, hi, Dennis. Yeah, Strathglass Park was built by Hugh Chisholm himself. I think 5 million bricks or something like that. He built these little townhouses really for the mill workers before the mill opened. Hugh Chisholm did a lot for the town. He not only built the housing, he built the infrastructure of the town. He built the canals. He was involved with the railroads. He owned the banks. He basically owned everything. He built schools. He built churches. He built the library. He donated to the library after it was built. But Strathglass Park was a really beautiful, he also wanted to build that because he didn't want to encounter sort of the what was perceived as like slum violence that was happening in Lowell, Mass and places like that. So he wanted to provide a home for the mill workers that were coming down from Canada or wherever they were coming from. So that's what Strathglass Park was all about. Right now it's in a bit of disrepair.
It was one of the first places in the state of Maine to have electricity, wasn't it?
I don't know. Is that true? I believe it is.
Okay. Well, Dennis, thank you. Thank you so much for her call. Going to an email from Diane. While reading Carrie Arsenault's book, I was so impressed by the woman who went door to door seeking questions on the health of her neighbors. Can Carrie tell us more about her? This is such an eye opener. I had no idea buying white paper cost us so much.
That was Terry Martin. That was Doc Martin's wife, who's also a nurse, and I hope is listening today. Terry was after Doc Martin died of cancer himself, I should say, Carrie didn't let the topic drop. And she said, what can I do? And I think she kind of that may have been a parallel to what happened in Love Canal, New York, where Mike Brown was a reporter that did the same kind of thing. He went door to door in Love Canal, New York, and was asking people like, who has cancer in your town? And why do they have cancer? And how many generations? Well, Terry kind of took it upon herself to do that. And she sent me those records. And it was stunning because that was the same neighborhood where my grandparents lived and my aunt and uncle. And I didn't know any of these. I knew all these families. I didn't know any of them had been so sick. But Terry has been, a huge, she's just tried and tried for years. And I feel like this book is a bit
both of our book.
Hmm. We'll go to Bryant Pond and Paul. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
She's just tried and tried for years. And
Paul, go ahead. And if you could turn down your radio.
We'll go to Bryant Pond and Paul. Hi.
She's just tried. Hi. Good morning. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. And it's good, best good. If your radio is turned down, Paul.
I turned it off.
Okay, great.
There is another book that, and I'm looking forward to reading your book a lot, but there's another book about Grofton, New Hampshire, and that's the town that I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and our story is so, so much the same. And that book is called You Had a Job for Life, a story of a company town. It's by Jamie Sayen. And I grew up in Grofton during the period, and right now the mill is gone now. It's actually been scrapped, and everything's been taken away. But I remember things like if you lived on the wrong side of the railroad tracks or on the wrong side of the river where the wind blew towards you, you breathed chemicals all day. I was lucky to live on the right side. On the right side, people they had a job for life guaranteed, but so many of them made it to retirement and died right away. They didn't get to enjoy a retirement because they had been poisoned. My uncle had been gassed in the 30s. He had been gassed as he pulled someone out of a chlorine tank who eventually died, but he saved the guy. At that point, my uncle was playing baseball in the minor leagues and was probably headed for the major leagues, but that stopped him there. It's just so much is similar in these meltdowns. I mean, I could go on with all the stories that you're going to hear in your book. Boy.
Paul, thank you so much for your call. Carrie, are you hearing from people in other towns?
I'm hearing from people in other towns in New England, but across the U.S. too, and it applies to, you know, mining towns, it applies to fracking towns, it applies to any sort of place where there's sort of dangerous work to be had. It's interesting he said that about the you know, people retire. I think I wrote about that too, is people that worked in the bleach room, they would give them jobs. They'd give them jobs in the bleach room only when they were older, is what I found out from a woman that worked in human resources. And then eventually when they retired, they didn't really live that much longer after that.
I have an email here from Gabrielle. How do we know that the new bleaching agent is less harmful to humans and the environment? Will we find out in 10 years that this is also harmful and cancer causing?
Yeah, I'm glad Dick Clapp brought that up. The chlorine dioxide is still a chlorinated compound or whatever. Maybe I'm using the wrong word, but it still does create dioxin just in really minuscule amounts. However, it's not, I wouldn't say that it's less problematic. I just think that there are rules. They say, you know, eat one fish a year, eat two lobsters a year. I think the rules are really the problem. You know, what makes it okay to eat any amount of dioxin when it's so dangerous? Because it is very, very dangerous, even in small amounts. The only way to eliminate it is to stop using those chlorinated compounds and to use, you know, there is peroxide or oxygen can also be used to bleach paper.
We'll go to Mark calling from Kingfield. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Am I on?
Yes.
Yeah. I grew up in Maine. I'm 62 years old. Grew up in paper mill towns in Woodland, Maine, Georgia Pacific. And then my father worked in the mills. He was an engineer. And we moved to Skowhegan when they built the Sappy plant in 1976. And I spent a career as a forester and then tuned into the forest products industry. There's some rainbows here. I mean, the remaining, you know, these dirty old mills that cause a lot of these environmental problems are gone. And a lot of them were grandfathered with the pollution laws to retain jobs. And, you know, there was a recent presentation by the recently retired head of procurement for Sappy North America, a very well-spoken lady, and hers was, you know, what was a quote from Mark Twain, the rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated. And the remaining mills in Maine are quite vibrant. I mean, Woodland Mill, owned by Asian Pulp Paper, just put in a big tissue plant. And, you know, Sappy and Skowhegan makes pet food bags. We also make a lot of rayon towels, fabric from towels. You know, the food packaging in Rumford and these remaining mills have modernized to stay viable and also not be the great polluters that they used to be.
Sure, sure. So, Carrie, Mark is optimistic about the future of the industry.
I'm not optimistic about the future of the industry, but I am. And I don't blame the industry itself for any kind of like toxic pollutants. I blame the leaders, and I blame the governments and the regulations. I mean, in 2018, our mill alone generated over 2.4 million pounds of toxics in that just one year. So, you know, we are the people, not just people in that town, but these pollutants travel, you know. Pollutants aren't provincial. They don't stay where we put them. So really, we're harming other people too, not just, you know. So while I do think that they have improved, for sure, I mean, definitely, there was a lot of improvements made. There's still a lot of toxics spewing out of these mills and what to do about them.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your call. We'll go to Pittsfield. And Paul, hi, Paul, go ahead.
Hi, everyone. And this is a great show. I just wanted to share a little bit of reminiscence when I heard the mention about the Mexico chicken coop and the, just remembering the delicious servings of frog legs they used to serve there, and I ate several times, and wondering if they came from the Androscoggin River, if I might have been affected by the dioxins from the river there. Anyway, I don't even know the chicken coop is still there, but I didn't hear that. Anyway, that was one of my fond memories, and then I also remembered a magazine advertisement about Fraser Paper that said, come see the blue skies over Rumford, Maine. And kind of an odd dichotomy when you think of what else was going on. That's really it, just that note.
Carrie.
Boy, you know, I feel bad. I mean, I did love growing up there too, but I didn't eat the frog legs. I did eat the bite-sized turkey at the chicken coop. I have to tell you, we'd go there on my birthday once a year. But, you know, like I say, it's not the people that are working there. It's their fault that these things have happened. It really isn't. And it's not to point the finger at anybody working there or to the town itself necessarily, but to the leaders of our state and of our towns. And they just need to do better. They need to choose life over death.
Paul, thanks for your call. We'll go to Edie in Blue Hill. Hi, Edie. Go ahead.
Okay. I just turned my radio off.
Yes.
So should I speak now?
Yes, please.
Okay. Hi, my name's Edie, and I live in Blue Hill. And I love this program. I work in healthcare. I'm a homeopathic practitioner, and I'm 72, so I've seen a lot of pollution in my life. Rachel Carson was a hero of mine growing up. And I wanted to mention a similar book, Living Downstream, by Sandra Steingraber, who's had issues with cancer from pollution. From farming. I also wanted to mention that dioxin was a big factor in California health too, with the forestry industry used as an herbicide. I wondered if you could say maybe a little about, is there any tension between the population that follows MOFCA, the Maine Organic Farming and Gardening Association, and the working class? You know, sometimes being an environmentalist is seen as being kind of highfalutin. And
And I'm going to cut you off, Edie, because we only have about 30 seconds left for Carrie to respond. Go ahead, Carrie.
I actually don't know, but I would guess that there is some tension, only how I referenced before, where I think there can be tension with, you know, people sticking their nose into communities where it doesn't really belong. It's like people telling them what to do in their own town. I feel like maybe that's a tension. I don't know. I didn't really come across that in my research, though.
Well, Carrie Arsenault, thank you so much for joining us. We will definitely put a link to your research project on our webpage, as well as information about your new book, Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. Today's sound engineer, John Keimel. You can visit mainecalling.org for more information about this program, to listen to previous programs, or to sign up for our podcast. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bangor Savings Bank, celebrating all the ways people all over Maine are making life a little better. Bangor.com/spreadkindness.